From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Our program this week focuses on two legal issues, efforts by religious colleges and universities to secure exemptions from federal regulations, and the latest appeals court ruling about affirmative action programs at the University of Texas in Austin. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note that you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our opening segment today, we'll discuss the effort of some institutions to seek religious exemptions from federal regulation. Joining us are Shapri Lomaggio, who is the Director of Governmental Relations and Executive Programs at the Council of Christian Colleges and Universities. Shane Windmeyer is the co-founder and executive director of Campus Pride, a national organization that advocates on behalf of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered students. Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Thank you all for joining us. Let me begin with a little bit of background information. The question is, should religiously affiliated institutions be exempt from key provisions of federal statutes? While religious exemptions have been widely discussed in the public conversation about the Affordable Health Care Act, most notably with regard to the Supreme Court's recent Hobby Lobby decision, some colleges and universities have also sought and secured exemptions from the provisions of Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, which bar education institutions from discriminating on the basis of gender. The current flashpoints in the conversations about Title IX and other religious exemptions involve two Christian colleges. George Fox University, which describes itself, quote, as Oregon's nationally recognized Christian university, secured an exemption from the U.S. Department of Education on some parts of Title IX requirements, which then allowed the university to refuse the request of a transgendered student who identifies as male to reside in male student housing on campus. As noted in Inside Higher Ed's story on the situation at George Fox, quote, a recent move by the Education Department to say that Title IX covers transgendered students gave their advocates great hope. And the George Fox decision now has many of them worried about the ability of religious colleges to discriminate against transgendered and possibly other students. And last week, a court in California ruled that California Baptist University could expel a transgendered student who applied to the university as a woman and who also identifies as a woman. Scott, let me turn to you for a little more background information about these two cases and other related issues.
Sure. Well, the issue of exemptions is not a new one. For instance, religious colleges have had the right to restrict hiring in certain positions or all positions to people who share their faith, or to say that their president, in some cases, will be a member of the clergy or will share a particular faith. The question is, how much and in what cases can you have exemptions? In addition to the two cases you mentioned, there are a series of legal challenges right now by religious colleges to being covered by the new healthcare law or parts of the new healthcare law that they view as discriminatory against their religious beliefs. So you have religious colleges saying we need to have ultimate flexibility to observe our faith. You then have people who are the victims of discrimination saying we want the coverage of Title IX and other laws.
Great. So as an observer, as a civilian in this conversation, Shapri and Shane, it seems to me that there is a tie that binds. And that tie that binds on both sides of this question is kind of a why us. I think for the religious institutions, for the Christian colleges, the why us question is, why are the feds targeting our colleges and attacking our religious commitments? And for the students who want to be part of communities at religious institutions, the why us question seems to be, why am I being discriminated against and why can I not participate? Is this a fair assessment? Shapri, let me begin with you. Is the why us question a fair question?
I think most of our institutions, the policies that you're referring to, they have had the policies for all or most of the duration of their existence. And so these aren't new policies, and they're not the new part of this is the shifting legal ground and shifting social views on some of these issues. And so I think it's not necessarily a question of being under attack. It's just a question of will, in shifting times, will religious colleges and universities be able to maintain the policies they've had and create diversity within the offerings of higher education, or will rights for one group trample or reduce the rights for religious colleges and universities?
And Shane, let me turn to you again. Is the why us question a fair one in terms of the feelings of students who feel that they are being discriminated against by religious institutions because of issues of faith and commitment?
Well, I think the why us, argument or kind of thought process is challenging because we have so many LGBTQ and straight ally youth who are also Christian and who have the identity just as anyone else does. And so it's not like they're coming into their faith or coming into a college as an outsider. They're part of Christianity. They're part of the Quaker mission. And, you know, it's important to recognize LGBTQ youth have a religious identity, and they want to be part of their religious identity like they were in their communities or in their families. And so I do think it's challenging. And at the end of the day, if a college that claims to be private is receiving federal public money, that's where there's the challenge. A private college that wants to be, you know, kind of this seclusive, organization that has policies or related to who we do and do not admit related to their sexual identity, gender identity. You know, back in 1985, George Fox had an exemption related to unwed and divorced parents. You know, that's fine if they're not receiving federal money, but the fact of the matter is they're not private because they are receiving federal money, and that's public money.
Well, let's turn to the issue of money. Hillsdale College in Michigan, famously some years ago, cut all federal and state money for its students. It found federal regulation to be onerous and obtrusive, and in conflict with the mission. So today, students at Hillsdale, which is a non-denominational, non-profit, post-secondary institution, undergraduate college, may not participate in federal funds. The college has found other ways to provide student aid for undergraduates. Now, admittedly, giving up federal money, specifically student aid, would be a major challenge for any college or university. But, Shapri, would not the release from the burden of Title IX regulations provide other offsetting benefits for institutions that have these kinds of commitments and don't want to feel themselves at the receiving end of federal regulation?
I think there's two separate issues there. I think the first one is the fact that the money actually goes to the students. And I think, I mean, this is something Scott would know well. The higher education community has always clearly articulated and defined that federal student aid stays with the student, and the wide variety of institutions allows a student to find an institution that best meets their needs and desires for what they want in an institution. And so the money goes to the student, and that allows students to have a wide variety of choices. On the second point is that this idea that because an institution receives any federal money, and in this case, if they received other grants or other types of money for LEED certified buildings or other things of that nature, that would definitively preclude their ability to have First Amendment rights and to exercise those, I think belies the entire notion of what the First Amendment does and why we have the First Amendment, and that is to allow religious freedom, and ultimately what that allows then is religious pluralism for people of all and no faith to coexist together in shared public space in a way that's hopefully respectful of one another, but that allows them to each maintain their beliefs without having to compromise those.
Well, but Scott, in the case of Hillsdale, the Hillsdale decision followed a very long series of court decisions that ultimately and conclusively affirmed the right of the feds to impose regulation on institutions, whether the money was direct grants or if it was indirect in terms of, Shapri said, the money was provided to students through student aid, and then the students took that money to a particular college or university. That's where the law, if you will, what many view critically as the long arm of the feds in this conversation, seems to apply in many of these instances. Isn't that the case?
Well, yes, and it keeps on getting debated. So, for instance, right now, another flashpoint in this discussion is that President Obama has said he is drafting an executive order to ban discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in a federal contract, among federal contractors. So a number of Christian organizations, including Gordon College, a college in Massachusetts, have said they would like an exemption in that executive order. So here again, while there might be some base law that has existed for a long time, like Title IX, Title VI, and others, this comes up in new ways all the time. And the question is, should there be an exemption or not? Gordon College has faced a lot of criticism in its region over its stance, although a lot of support from similar colleges in other parts of the country. So even if the law is established, every time there's a new program or a new law, this gets debated again.
Well, Shane, though, it seems like in one sense, I recognize you're not an attorney, but the sort of the part of the legal precedent would almost date back to Bob Jones University some years ago, which after, again, prolonged court cases, the IRS ruled would take away its tax-exempt status because it did engage in discrimination, in this case on the basis of racial discrimination, yet the university cited scripture, an issue which later was rendered moot by a later edict by the university president. To what degree should Title IX and other regulations apply to religious institutions?
Well, I think you bring up a really important problem with scripture and with religious beliefs is that even amongst the Quaker religion, there's not agreement on the issue of LGBTQ folks. And if anything, they're a more progressive religion when it comes to LGBTQ issues. And so, you know, when we talk about the First Amendment, you know, the Establishment Clause, it's a two-way street. It's not just about restricting the free practice of religion, but also it's not about establishing it. And, you know, having, public monies in any form, going to students, and we talk about choice, let's simplify this issue. Jay simply wanted to be a roommate to his friends. He didn't want to go in and do anything other than, be with his buddies and, have a room. And many colleges are realizing they have to provide choice or else their enrollment figures are going to be dropping in the future related to choice with students, regardless of their sexual identity, regardless of their faith or religious identity or their gender identity. So I think there's a lot more here. And I think you bring up a good example about how, who decides what, individual religious belief at a college, such as George Fox, is, because I think that differs. And these students, are Quakers as well. They're Christians as well.
Scott, are there other issues about the George Fox situation that have special bearing in this case, in this instance?
Well, I think the George Fox example, and Jace, that Shane just mentioned that name, is the name of the student there. George Fox also, frankly, represents the way societal attitudes and issues evolve. My guess is 10 years ago, George Fox probably didn't have a policy on transgender students. Now they had one, and then they've tweaked it a bit this week, and they're facing criticism for it. And Shane mentioned that George Fox, in 1985, had a different set of policies where they didn't want to be required to hire or admit unwed parents or divorced people. These attitudes are changing very rapidly in society, and I think George Fox is a perfect example of where an approach that might have been not challenged a generation ago is now facing challenge. And that's not just George Fox, it's religious colleges all over the country.
So I want to close with two questions, one directed specifically at Shane and the second to Shapri. Shane, observers would look at this situation and say, I say this very cautiously and very carefully. They might read about George Fox and California Baptist and other similar cases and say, why go where you are not welcomed? Admittedly, and I want to say very cautiously, this may sound like the argument of Southern governors who were aggressively hostile to school desegregation in the years following the historic Brown versus Board of Education decision. But if other academic programs and institutions are accepting, why seek a place where there's going to be tension?
I think for young people today, they're growing up in a society that welcomes their who they are, and that's holistically. And faith is important to many young people today. It's just not a faith of of discrimination. It's a faith that's inclusive. And, you know, for the Quaker religion, for Christians, there are many Christians who accept and who welcome lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans people because they are Christians just like them. And so these students are going there for the experience, for the education. Sometimes their parents have went there, and there's a legacy involved. And I think for a faith-based institution, they have an opportunity like others. I mean, there's just as there are faith-based institutions that, you know, have, you know, these, in my opinion, kind of arcane policies, there's many faith-based institutions that are doing inclusive measures to welcome LGBTQ students. And so, you know, I think it's one of those issues where George Fox needs to evolve to meet their students where they're at today. And, you know, I just don't want, you know, my good friend AJ, who was a student and one of our leaders, you can go online to our Campus Pride YouTube channel and you can hear about AJ's, you know, experience at George Fox. And AJ's an amazing leader, but had to go through some really challenging situations that ultimately impacted his safety. And no student should have to pay to go to college and feel unsafe.
And Shapri, on the flip side of this issue, in the wake of federal regulations, which the courts have affirmed, the feds can and use Title IX and other legislation to deal with the issue of discrimination. Why is it, should religious institutions be able to deny admission and deny support to students who seek acceptance with the community represented by Christian institutions?
I think that what I would describe is our institutions as places that are looking for members of the community that agree with and want to participate in the shared vision and mission of that institution, including at many of the institution's specific standards of conduct. That's what the missions of those institutions have long been, and that is consistent with the policies that they've created here. And I think you do see, to Shane's point, conversations happening on our campuses, and I think I can speak definitively that every campus would want all students on their at their institution to be safe and to have safety. But that's but the question here, not to conflate the two, is our institutions, yes, Title IX exists. Yes, it has been upheld, as has the religious exemption, which was put into Title IX from its inception and has been upheld time and time again. Because what it allows is for each institution to have policies that are consistent with its religious beliefs, and it allows institutions to consider, as circumstances change and as times change, what that means. But really, it's the question of who do we want being the referee in this conversation? Do we want the government refereeing various beliefs, or do we want for each individual community to be able to decide on their own what their beliefs are?
Great. Thank you all. Shapri Lamaggio from the Council of Christian Colleges and Universities, Shane Windmeyer from Campus Pride, and Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed. Good conversation. In our second segment today, we will discuss pursuing inclusion in Texas and a recent appeals court decision affirming the Affirmative Action Program at the University of Texas, Austin. Joining us is Rod Smola, who's a constitutional law scholar, the author of The Constitution Goes to College. He's the former president of Furman University and currently a visiting professor at the University of Georgia Law School. And staying with us is Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. By way of background, in Texas this week, a federal appeals court handed the University of Texas a victory, perhaps a short-term one, when it ruled that the university's top 10% plus plan, which guarantees undergraduate admission to the top 10% of high school graduates across the state, plus supplemental admissions procedures for additional students, was a legal form of affirmative action. The appeals court ruling followed the Supreme Court decision last June in Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin, which sent the decision about the Texas plan, the 10% policy plus supplemental efforts by the university to increase minority enrollment, back to the appeals court. The text of the 2-1 decision permits the university to go beyond the 10% policy in its efforts to diversify its undergraduate student population, specifically stating that, quote, critical mass, the tipping point of diversity, has no fixed upper bound of universal application, nor is it the minimum threshold at which minority students do not feel isolated or like spokespersons for their race. Moreover, the appeals court also affirmed that the University of Texas is correct not to depend on just the 10% plan to diversify its undergraduate student population, because the plan only works because so many minority students in Texas attend what the court described as segregated schools. Quote, while the top 10% plan boosts minority enrollment by skimming from the tops of Texas high schools, it does so against the backdrop of increasing resegregation in Texas public schools, where over half of Hispanic students and 40% of black students attend a school with 90 to 100% minority enrollment. Scott Fisher has been with us for a while, and it looks like it still will be. What else do we need to understand about sort of the ups and downs and arounds of this case?
Well, you're right. This case has been around for a while, and last year the U.S. Supreme Court heard the case, and they used it to say that, yes, public colleges and universities can consider race in admissions, but they felt that previous reviews of this case by lower courts had not held Texas to a high enough standard. And so they said that strict scrutiny needed to be applied and that no special deference should go to the University of Texas. And then they sent it back to the appeals court. So while it was a victory in that it did not kill affirmative action, as critics of affirmative action had hoped, it set a very high standard. Many wondered whether Texas could get over it. And there's no doubt in my mind that whatever happens now, this is going to head back to the Supreme Court. And that should concern, I think, supporters of affirmative action, because the court has some tendency to take on race issues in a two-step process, where first they sort of make it hard to do something, and then they ban it, and there's some concern that could happen here.
So, Rod Smola, as a constitutional scholar, also as a former college university president, as you look at this case, clearly, as Scott said, it looks like it's going to be heading back to the Supreme Court. You know, on the other hand, the appeals courts have made some very strong statements affirming the activity and describing the context of what's going on at Texas. What else do we need to understand about what will happen next in terms of this process?
The Supreme Court follows what's known as the rule of four, which is that it only takes four justices to vote to hear a case, even though, of course, typically it takes five to decide the outcome. And we know for a certainty that there are at least four justices that are deeply skeptical of what Texas has done, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Clarence Thomas. So those four alone, I am sure, will find the Fifth Circuit's ruling, which we should emphasize is a 2-1 ruling with a very powerful dissenting opinion, those four will find the majority opinion decided earlier this week very unsatisfying, and I can't imagine them not voting to take the case back up. So I think that is one important thing to know. And the other important thing to know, which we can get into more deeply soon, is that really I think everyone was expecting the lower courts, the Fifth Circuit, or maybe even the trial court, if it was sent back down to the trial court, to hear more evidence and to engage in a much more searching, detailed investigation of the University of Texas's justifications for this, and that simply did not happen. Essentially, the Fifth Circuit had a do-over, and it did it over without any additional homework, and I think that will prove very dicey for the defenders of what Texas has done when it reaches the Supreme Court again.
So then what, Rod, let me come back to you. What should we expect? I mean, as Scott noted in the article he wrote the last couple of days for Inside Higher Ed describing the appeals court decision, the Supreme Court has not retreated from the view that diversity is a legitimate goal for a college to have on the way it educates students. The appeals court decision talked about critical mass. This was not just the students admitted by the top 10% plan, but there was also a supplemental plan that applied not just to minority students, but also to white students. As we look at this process going forward, you talked about the strength of a very strong dissent. We also had a very strong affirming opinion. What should we expect?
Well, the first thing to say is there is a little bit of a surreal or artificial quality to this case, because the plaintiff, Abigail Fisher, has never invited the Supreme Court to re-examine the decisions in the Michigan case, in the Grutter case, and to re-examine that basic question of whether diversity is a compelling goal for universities. Even so, there's no doubt that that's the subtext here. And four justices at least, maybe more, are uneasy about that basic premise. It's almost like a married couple having an argument over something trivial when what's really going on is a deeper dysfunctionality in the relationship. And so that is still kind of brewing all around this case. You asked about the critical mass and the deference, and I think when this goes back to the Supreme Court, this is what you will hear in oral argument. You will hear the skeptical justices hammering Texas again, saying, how do you know you have a critical mass? How do you define that? What does that mean? And then you will hear the justices saying, even if you're right that diversity is good for education, prove to us that you had to use race consciousness to get there. Prove to us that the 10% system that you've enacted isn't good enough. And I think that Texas will have a hard time answering those questions persuasively to that block of justices.
Scott, to civilians like myself, admittedly I'm not an attorney, I know you cover a lot of legal issues as a journalist, one of the sort of baffling things about this case is the issue of standing versus merit. Abigail Fisher went to another institution, she's already graduated from college, and yet this case is still with us years after the moment of the initial, if you will, slight or offense, if you're Ms. Fisher, and the initial filing. Why does this case remain if, in fact, the aggrieved party, Abigail Fisher, has already gotten her baccalaureate degree and is going on with her life?
Well, I mean, that's one of the arguments made by the University of Texas, that she doesn't have standing. The Supreme Court, though, when they sent this case back to the appeals court, at least as the majority interpreted it, they didn't want another ruling on standing. And in fact, the majority opinion in the appeals court this week suggested they had doubts about standing, but that they felt their instructions were to look at this from the perspective of merits. I would argue that in the long term that this may not be a crucial issue of standing, because critics of affirmative action have been pretty successful at identifying plaintiffs for their cases. In fact, they're right now advertising, looking for new plaintiffs at selected universities. So if it wasn't Abigail Fisher, it would be somebody else.
All right. And
I agree with that. And this is one of those situations where it takes longer to complete a lawsuit than it does to complete a college degree. And so this is constantly going to be evading review if that's going to be the standard. So I think the Supreme Court's probably going to overlook the standing issues. And there's a fair argument that she has standing, even though she's already graduated from LSU, and I suspect the court will grab onto that.
Let's turn to the practical applications of this. Rod, you've been a college president. Scott, you watch a lot of these things. If I'm on a college campus, specifically a public college or university at this point, whether I'm in Texas or elsewhere, what's the message that comes out of the appeals court decision, and what should I be anticipating, assuming, as you both have suggested, this Fisher goes back to the Supreme Court in the coming months? Scott, let me begin with you and then go to Rod. So as you think about the conversations
Sure.
presidents and admissions officers are having, what's the impact, what's the shadow of this round of the Fisher decision?
Well, if you're in a state with a percent plan, what you have to be able to do is prove that that's not enough. And the majority here thought Texas did so, but it's only a minority of states that have percent plans. In many states, you know, as Rod was saying, percent plans rely on segregation, basically. And in many states, you don't have enough segregation to make a percent plan work. So in any state, the question is going to be, or in any state university, the question is going to be, can you show that race neutral, and that's not just percent plans, that's stepped up recruiting, it's efforts to improve public schools, it's reconsidering your admission standards, all of those things you have to show aren't enough. And you also have to show, I suspect the judges will also be asking a lot about, can you show you have a plan to get beyond this, to reach a point where you wouldn't need to use race consideration. That is going to be hard for a lot of institutions.
So just for point of clarification, let's be sure that we understand that in the context of segregation at this point, we're talking about just the fact that as the court indicate in its decision this week, large numbers of minority students attend almost overwhelmingly minority schools, just as the reference for resegregation.
Yeah, yeah. In Texas, that's definitely the case, and so that means the top 10% of a certain number of schools are almost all Latinos. In others, they're overwhelmingly Black. So you have this critical mass, whether it's enough is open for debate, coming into the UT system.
And Rod, again, both as a constitutional scholar, but also as a former college president, as you sort of survey the landscape and think about the conversations that presidents and admissions officers are having, what's the shadow that's cast by the Fisher decision?
Of a university, and I ask the admissions officer and the legal counsel of the university, what's the prognosis? The lawyer would probably revert to the very technical legal term, which comes from Jackie Gleason. He'd go, or she'd go, homina, 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 homina. The fact is nobody knows. And I think what most universities probably ought to do right now is what they believe is educationally sound, what they believe is best fitting with their mission and their values, and whether you are a state university or a private university, continue to pursue an admissions program that you believe makes sense for the university and for the country and for your students until the Supreme Court of the United States gives contrary instructions. After all, you have a Fifth Circuit decision that says nothing has changed. You have President Obama's administration saying that nothing has changed. And at least as of this moment, nothing has changed. But it is important to remember, I think this is a very important sort of concluding point, although this arises in the context of the 14th Amendment and a famous state university, the University of Texas, it happens that this rule will apply to both public and private universities, because going way back to the Bakke decision in the 1970s, the Supreme Court decided that any university that receives federal aid, and that's 98% of the universities in the country, is also bound by this rule, because federal civil rights laws have married the concepts of the 14th Amendment to federal civil rights laws. And so this will have a profound impact, not just for schools like the University of Texas, but for virtually all privates in the United States as well.
So, Scott, universities and colleges have been grappling with alternatives. We see a little of this in the supplemental plan at Texas in terms of holistic assessment. Many other public institutions, selective and otherwise, are doing the same as well. There's a growing conversation, that began in the wake of the Bakke decision in 1978, about alternatives to race that might be based on class. There's an argument now about place that's beginning to emerge as opposed to class or race. What's the likelihood of finding reasonable substitutes for the notion, for the concept of race in the admissions process?
It's going to be difficult, because if you look at studies of class-based affirmative action, some studies, most notably of the University of Colorado, have suggested it can preserve a critical mass of racial diversity. Others have not. Some colleges are instead moving to drop required ACT or SAT, feeling that that will make it easier for them to put an emphasis on things on which white and Asian students don't, on average, do much better. And then the other thing that I think is really important to remember going ahead is that it is only a minority of colleges that have sufficiently competitive admissions that they are really needing to use race-based affirmative action to admit students. There are an awful lot of Black and Latino students being recruited and admitted and graduating from colleges and universities has nothing to do with affirmative action. But there is a perception issue when it's in the news, when it's in the courts, that tends to have negative impacts on race relations and negative impacts on students of all races and ethnicities feeling welcome. So in addition to the legal issues, there's a lot of recruitment and perception issues at the same time.
Great. My thanks to you both for the informative conversation about a very difficult issue. And that's our program for this week. Our thanks to Shapri Lomaggio of the Council of Christian Colleges, Shane Windmeyer of Campus Pride, and Rodney Smola of the University of Georgia Law School, as well as to Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed for joining us for the conversation. This Week in Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoons on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.